From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. He's been called the Teflon Don. Mob boss John Gotti has beaten three separate crime raps in the past 4 years. On this edition of Fresh Air, investigative journalist Ernest Volkman gives us some background on how Gotti and his crime family operate. Also today, filmmaker John Waters confesses to dancing the bunny hop and going to charm school. It's what all the squares do in his new comedy, Crybaby, an homage to the teen exploitation films of the 50s. And TV critic David Bianculli has a review of TV's latest attempt to go inside a big city newsroom. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet leaders have rejected offers of compromise from the breakaway government of Lithuania and today announced plans to step up pressure designed to force the republic to withdraw its declaration of independence. The Lithuanian parliament appealed to the Soviets last week to hold talks on the matter and indicated a willingness to compromise on some issues. It refused, however, to abandon the declaration of independence. A statement from the Soviet Council to the president called the Lithuanian proposal a dead end. The statement said the Soviets have decided to take further economic, political, and other measures against the Lithuanian government. In Hungary, talks are already underway to form a new government after Sunday's runoff vote that gave an overwhelming victory to the center-right Democratic Forum. The elections confirmed the apparent anti-leftist trend in Eastern Europe, but they were also marred by a voter turnout of only 44%. Sylvia Poggioli reports.
Democratic Forum leader Jozef Antal, who will probably be Hungary's next prime minister, said negotiations are underway with two other conservative parties, the Smallholders and Christian Democrats, and that he hopes the government will be formed within a month. Antal said the government's first task is to pull the country out of its severe economic crisis after 40 years of communist rule, and that Hungary would seek membership in the European Community. The result was a severe disappointment to Forum's closest rival, the Liberal Free Democrats, who pushed for more radical economic reforms. Leader Janos Kish blamed the party's poor showing on what he called a campaign of slander, but said it would be a responsible opposition party in parliament. This is Sylvia Poggioli reporting.
The Bush administration today deplored the decision by the government of Iraq to expel an American official from Baghdad. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The official Iraqi news agency announced today that an unidentified American diplomat would be expelled in retaliation for Washington's expulsion of an Iraqi diplomat last week. Today, the State Department's Margaret Tutwiler said Iraq's action was unjustified and inappropriate.
Iraq's decision appears to have been taken solely in reprisal for the expulsion of an Iraqi diplomat in New York whose activities were incompatible with his status.
That official was expelled last week for his alleged involvement in a plot to murder political opponents of President Saddam Hussein who were active in California. According to an indictment handed down Friday, a former employee of Iraq's United Nations mission was charged with interstate travel for purposes of murder for hire. The indictment alleges that the accused was hired by the Iraqi diplomat who was expelled last week. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Prices were mixed at the close of the New York Stock Exchange today. It was one of the lightest trading days of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 5 points to close at 2,722.07. Declines led advances 4-3 on volume of 115 million shares. This is NPR News. Swedish police placed the death toll in this weekend's fire aboard a Norwegian ferry boat at 170 and say it could go higher. They say that many of the victims of the suspicious blaze on the ferry Scandinavian Star were children. In Britain, police began an arson investigation of a fire on the Irish Sea car ferry Norona that killed one man early today and injured 32 people. In a third incident involving a fire aboard a ferry, a blaze also broke out today in the engine room of a French ferry in the English Channel. NASA is making final preparations for the planned launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery tomorrow morning. The orbiter will carry the $1.5 billion Hubble Space Telescope into space for what NASA hopes will be the best view of the universe ever offered to scientists. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE has more.
launch of the shuttle Discovery is set for 8:47 Eastern Time tomorrow morning, 2 days ahead of its original launch date. Preparations for liftoff had gone so smoothly that NASA managers cut 2 days of contingency time, allowing for the April 10th blastoff. According to NASA's Bruce Buckingham, the only thing standing in the way of a perfect liftoff would be the Florida weather.
Well, hardware-wise, according to our reports from our engineers working on the orbiter and on the Hubble Space Telescope, everything is looking fine. The only concern we have at this time is some possible low clouds at the beginning of our window tomorrow morning.
Despite the threat of those low clouds, NASA has a window of nearly 2.5 hours in which to launch. Aboard Discovery is the Hubble Space Telescope. Astronauts will deploy Hubble 360 miles above the Earth. Its first crystal clear pictures of the universe will be sent to Earth in about a month. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli in Orlando.
World leaders are calling on drug users around the world to accept responsibility for the $500 billion drug trade. Delegates from 112 countries are in London this week for a conference on the drug problem. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Gotti has been described by law enforcement authorities as the nation's top mafia boss. He's the reputed head of the Gambino family, the richest and most powerful mafia group in the U.S. The FBI estimates that the 49-year-old Gotti oversees narcotics, loan sharking, gambling, and labor rackets that take in over $100 million a year. Gotti is the subject of a new book by Ernest Volkman and John Cummings, two former Newsday investigative reporters who have written extensively about organized crime. Ernest Volkman is my guest. John Gotti has developed a reputation for legal invincibility. He was acquitted on criminal charges 3 times in the last 4 years. The latest was in February in a highly publicized New York trial. Gotti was found innocent of ordering the 1986 shooting and wounding of a Carpenters Union official named John O'Connor. But there are rumors that Gotti will soon be indicted for complicity in the 1985 murder of Paul Castellano, the former head of the Gambino family who Gotti replaced. Speculation is that prosecutors will use the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO. RICO has been used to successfully prosecute many crime organizations. Volkman predicts that Gotti's legal invincibility is about to end.
Sometime in the not-too-distant future, John Gotti is going to be hit with a RICO case, the likes of which you have never seen. And it's a RICO case he will not beat. And it's a RICO case that will be primarily put together by the FBI. That is the one agency that has not yet prosecuted him.
Do you have inside information on that, or are you just speculating?
I have inside information, and I'm personally guaranteeing you that Mr. Gotti will be convicted and go to jail.
Do you think that mafia defense lawyers have developed new, very effective techniques in recent years?
No, interestingly enough, mafia defense lawyers are pretty much a throwback to the 30s. They are loud. They are flamboyant. They hit below the belt. They pull every trick they can. And the reason for that is that's the way their clients want it. It's very interesting that mafia defendants prefer a particular style in defense lawyers. They like a lot of screaming. They like a lot of yelling. They like a lot of jumping up and down, like you see in the movies. In the real world, of course, as everybody knows, the more effective lawyers are the ones who are very quiet, and the ones who impress juries with very detailed cross-examinations that tear a prosecution case to shreds. But not mafia defendants. These are guys who are not into legal subtleties of any kind, and they like lawyers who look like something out of a grade B movie.
What are the legal concerns you have as the author of this new book, Gumbada? After all, Gotti has been acquitted 3 times in 4 years, and in your book you're making all kinds of charges of things that he's been guilty of. He's never admitted to being the head of a crime family even, and certainly it hasn't been proven in court yet. So what do you have to do to protect yourself when you write a book like this? To protect yourself from lawsuits, but also to protect yourself from assault by people who you're writing about.
Terry, it would make my day if John Gotti would sue me for libel. I would love it if he would sue me, because we would immediately cite truth as a defense, and I would be extremely happy, believe me, to have John Gotti sitting across from me in a lawyer's office forced to answer a lot of questions about his criminal career.
But are you saying you don't think that would happen?
Let's put it this way. I have never known a mafia person of any rank to sue for libel. They don't give interviews. They don't sue for libel. And they tend really not to read too many books anyway.
Do you worry about personal injury?
No, I've been in this business for a long time, Terry, and one of the first lessons you learn when you get into it is that you can't have it both ways. If you're going to write about the underworld and organized crime and people who have killed other people for a living, part of the price is that sometimes they may not like what you write and they may possibly come after you. That comes with the territory.
My guest is Ernest Volkman, co-author of the new book, Gumbado, which is the story of John Gotti. You describe Gotti as a hero to the new generation of mobsters, mob yuppies. Just describe what you mean by mob yuppies.
One of the striking things to me about the current mafia is that, like many other American institutions, it's becoming yuppified. We have a whole new generation of young mafia punks now coming into leadership positions, particularly since the old generation has been badly decimated by a federal crackdown. And these new guys coming into positions of power, they are not the old godfathers that you and I remember from the movies. These are materialists. They look like college graduates, most of them, which a considerable portion of them are. They look like your average yuppie on the street. And these are guys who are totally and completely into materialism.
Well, hasn't the mob always been into materialism?
Yes, but they always were very careful to conceal it. Let's take, for example, probably the greatest godfather the mafia ever produced, Carlo Gambino. Carlo Gambino, for 40 years, was the most powerful organized crime leader in the entire world. And yet, you'd never know it. I don't think that Carlo Gambino ever spent more than $30 on an outfit in his life. He looked like an old Italian street sweeper. He had an old battered hat, he had old clothes, he had a very modest house, and he had an even more modest summer house. Officially, he was a real estate salesman for 40 years. Yet, he was, as they used to call him, capo di tutti capi, boss of all bosses. A man who, with the flick of his finger, could get you killed. A man who earned an estimated $300 million a year. Yet Carlo Gambino was the kind of guy who said, look, you've got to have a low profile. Provided you keep a low profile and you don't get involved in narcotics and you don't shoot cops and you don't shoot innocent citizens on the street, basically the United States of America will adopt a laissez-faire attitude towards you. They will let you get away with organized crime. Just don't get crazy about it.
What are the differences in operation style between the new mafia and the old mafia?
Well, John Gotti, I think, is the ultimate personification of the new mafia. First of all, he's flashy. He takes great pride in being seen. He's very concerned about his public appearance. He wears $1,800 suits. He thumbs his nose at the law enforcement establishment, and he walks around with an air of, look, I'm the godfather. Try and get me, nah. That's how John Gotti walks around. That's a very sharp contrast from the old days.
Now, you say that Gotti became crime boss of the Gambino family after engineering the murder of the Gambino family boss, Paul Castellano.
Yes.
Why did he do that?
Paul Castellano was in the way, number one. And number two, Paul Castellano had become extremely upset about one of the young punks under him by name of John Gotti. And Paul Castellano became convinced it was only a matter of time before John Gotti, an extremely ambitious hood, would attempt to take over the post of boss. And so shortly before his death, Castellano had begun making a series of moves designed to clip John Gotti's wings. John Gotti, in turn, became convinced that it was only a matter of time that Castellano would have him eliminated. So therefore, to him, it came down to a question of kill or be killed.
And there must be a lot of unique problems in murdering a crime boss.
Yes. I mean, the first problem you have in murdering a crime boss is that it causes a lot of unrest throughout the rest of the mafia. There is a very firm mafia rule which says you cannot raise hands against a fellow made member. That means anything from slapping him in the face to killing him. That is an absolute no-no. killing a family boss is a very, very serious step. Almost always you have to go to what's called a commission. That is an kind of ruling body for the entire 24 families of the American Mafia. And you must get at least tacit approval from them to carry out a killing. To get that approval, you better have a very, very good reason. You have to say, well, look, this guy is not taking care of his people. This man is stealing money. This man is doing this or that and the other thing. And therefore, logic dictates that this man must be eliminated.
Has Gotti stood trial for the murder of Castellano?
Nobody will, very shortly.
This is what you were referring to before?
Yes, so that one of the charges that John Gotti will face will be arranging the murder of Paul Castellano.
Now, Paul Castellano had issued an edict against narcotics trafficking, and Gotti thought that that was aimed at him?
Well, first of all, it's very important to understand that Paul Castellano was one of the largest narcotics traffickers in the United States. Now, that sounds rather odd that a man who was a narcotics trafficker of Castellano's dimension would then issue an edict barring narcotics trafficking by members of his own family. Let me quickly explain how this came about. The Mafia some years ago decided that the problem was that they had to work through cutouts, that it was too dangerous to get directly involved in the narcotics trade, which trade, by the way, the Mafia has dominated for at least the past 70 years, and that continues to this day. So what they came up with was a very simple organizational plan. Big narcotics deals would be handled by a series of cutouts who, if necessary, would take the fall, meaning that they would take the conviction in the event they were caught. Anyone else in the family who dealt in narcotics was subject to an immediate death penalty. And the reason for that was quite practical. There was no moral issue here at all, as far as the Mafia was concerned. Narcotics charges in this country are very, very serious, and judges tend to hit people convicted of handling drugs with very heavy sentences. In the federal courts, you can see sentences ranging from 47 years up to 120 years. What does that mean? Well, it means that a Mafia soldier, a Mafia captain, anybody in the Mafia who gets caught dealing in narcotics is subject to extremely heavy pressure by law enforcement people who can say, look, you're facing life in prison. If you're 40 years old and you just got an 80-year sentence, you're going to die in prison. That makes them very vulnerable to making a deal. Keep in mind that Joe Valachi, probably the most famous Mafia informant in this century, his road to perdition, to use the Mafia's phrase, began when he was arrested for heroin trafficking.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about organized crime, and we'll talk more about narcotics and organized crime. My guest is Ernest Volkman, who's written a lot about organized crime over the years. His new book is called Gumbada, and it's the story of John Gotti, who is the head of one of the New York crime families, the Gambino family. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about organized crime. My guest is Ernest Volkman. So Paul Castellano had this edict to keep the rest of the people from his crime family out of narcotics so that he'd have a monopoly on it and so that they couldn't get him into trouble. Paul Castellano was knocked off. The head of the family now is John Gotti. You've called him the largest narcotics trafficker in the country.
No, I've said one of the largest.
One of the largest.
Right, right.
What's his technique?
John Gotti, from the first moment that he became a rising power in the Mafia, decided that he was going to get involved in narcotics. John Gotti and his brother, I should point out, is currently serving 50 years in federal prison for narcotics trafficking. John Gotti and his brother and a number of his close friends decided that they would evade or attempt to evade Castellano's and indeed the Mafia's ban on dealing in narcotics by members of the mafia. That was the one way they could make a tremendous amount of money in one fell swoop. And indeed, the people involved in John Gotti's little ring had so much money that they were carrying around cash in shopping bags at one point.
Are Gotti's techniques of drug trafficking any different than the Castellano techniques were?
Yes. Paul Castellano, like other mafia godfathers, was extremely careful. Take, for example, Carlo Gambino, who originally set up this whole operation. Carlo Gambino used as a cutout a baker living in the Bronx who lived in a very modest little home. He was the man who, however, was making monthly trips to Sicily and handling somewhere around $50 million a year worth of heroin transactions. When the federal agents finally tumbled to him, they dug up his yard and they found $9 million in cash buried in his backyard. Paul Castellano used the owner of a chain of grocery stores to run his heroin operations. Now, Gotti, by contrast, was quite open about it. One of the reasons why Paul Castellano began to get a little dicey was that he began hearing reports that John Gotti was not only dealing in narcotics, but he was doing it openly, and he was directly involved. This was an absolute no-no. Part of the change in style that John Gotti has brought to the so-called new mafia is an open acknowledgement for the first time. He has made it very clear to everybody that the old days are over, and if you want to deal in dope, you go right ahead and deal in dope, provided, of course, you give him a good portion of the profits.
That leaves him more vulnerable, though, doesn't it?
It does. You're absolutely right. There are a lot of people in the mafia who think this is a serious strategic error, that it is only a matter of time before Gotti gets nailed in a narcotics case. They point out that Gene Gotti and three of John Gotti's closest friends were recently convicted in a major heroin operation, and it was only through luck that the federal agents were not able to bring John Gotti into that case.
I was under the understanding that the mafia has become less important in narcotics trafficking in the United States because so much of the mafia has been busted up and put behind bars on RICO trials. You're saying that's not true?
It's only partially true. It depends on what kind of narcotics you want. Let us say, for example, you're interested in heroin. Now, there's many kinds of heroin. You can get China White, which is the kind of heroin that comes in from Southeast Asia. You can get so-called Mexican Brown, which is a much inferior form that comes up from South America and is smuggled in through Mexico. Or you can get what is called a dope world's Tiffany of junk, and that's Sicilian heroin. Now, if you really want good heroin, you want Sicilian heroin. And there's only one organization in the world that controls that traffic, and that's the mafia. Similarly, if you want certain kinds of very high-grade narcotics, it is only the mafia that has access to that.
Ernest Volkman is my guest, and he's written extensively about organized crime in the United States, and his new book, Gumbada, is the story of John Gotti, who's the head of one of the New York crime families. What would you say the Gambino crime families innovations, so to speak, have been within organized crime?
The chief contribution they've made, and it's one that as a society we've had to bear the burden of, is its infiltration into the legitimate side of the economy. Carlo Gambino, the founding progenitor of that family, was the guy who understood that organized crime, while most of us decry it, also has a lot of law-abiding citizens who like to do business with it. Whether you want to buy pornography, whether you want to gamble illegally, whether you want to get some drugs, whether you want to buy some hot goods and save a few dollars, whether you want to get a car at a very steep discount, and a million and other services, organized crime can provide them for you, provided you're willing to pay the price. And that is where the Gambino family, which is the single most powerful criminal organization in the United States, that is where they made their big breakthrough. And as a result, now you've got a wide range of businesses in this country in which the Gambino family plays a very, very key role. In New York, where the concrete industry has been badly infiltrated, particularly by the Gambino family, the costs of dealing with the mob are passed on to the consumers. The same is true in the garbage business, and most particularly true, unfortunately, in the restaurant business. If you go into a lot of restaurants, particularly in New York, you'll be struck by very, very high prices. Only part of that is related to the actual management of the restaurant. There is a special mafia tax you pay because that restaurant in some way is dealing with the mob. Not necessarily that three guys in shark skin suits come in with guns, smack the head chef in the face and say, look, give me $10. It doesn't work that way anymore. What the Gambino family has pioneered is that particular restaurant, almost certainly what they've done is take over the subsidiary services of the restaurant. In other words, the linen supply company to that restaurant, the service that provides the silverware, the service that provides the cleaning of the restaurant, and a dozen other services, those they control, and that's where they make their money.
Ernest Volkman is my guest. He's a reporter who has written extensively on organized crime, and his new book is about John Gotti. It's called Gumbada. I want to ask you a little bit about how you did the research for this book.
And very carefully.
Yeah, well, you know, in your introduction, you say that you spoke to people on both sides of the law and that almost all of the people contributing to your reporting would prefer not to be named publicly.
Yes.
So, I mean, how do you make the kinds of contacts on the other side of the law that you need to get the information to write a book like this?
With great difficulty. Again, this comes with the territory. At this stage, my partner and I, John Cummings, who shared with me the task of putting the book together, I think to date we have spent more time in prison than most felons in the state of New York. And I'm convinced that if he or I were ever convicted of a crime in the near future, we could probably argue successfully for time already served. A lot of people that we wanted to talk to, regrettably, were enjoying at that time the hospitality of either the state of New York correctional system or the federal government's much-heralded correction system. Going to jail is endemic to people in the mafia. It comes with the territory. They accept it. And the chances usually are good that if you're going to talk to somebody in the mafia, of course, you're not going to quote them by name if you can avoid it, since that might cause them health difficulties. The odds are good that you're going to meet them in prison. A lot of these people you get to know after a while. They operate in a world where there aren't many written contracts and court suits and things like that. And they tend to rely on reputation and a person's word. If someone understands that you are straight, that is to say that you are exactly who you say you are and you do exactly what you say you will do, they will talk to you after a while, particularly if they have a motive for talking.
So you're predicting that John Gotti is going to be back on trial real soon in a big case that will be his ultimate downfall.
I'm not predicting it. I'm stating as a fact.
Okay. You plan on uncovering that as well, sticking with the story?
I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about organized crime. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Nice to talk to you again.
Ernest Volkman's new book is called Gumbada, The Improbable Rise and Fall of John Gotti and His Gang. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Waters has made a new movie musical inspired by the rock and roll teen films of the 50s. Squares and hoods sing and dance and vie for the loyalty of a teen queen. Coming up, John Waters on recreating the juvenile delinquency he missed out on. And TV critic David Bianculli checks out Capital News, starring Lloyd Bridges as the head of a pack of news-hungry reporters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet leader Gorbachev's presidential council has turned down a call from Lithuania for negotiations over its independence declaration. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
President Gorbachev chaired a meeting of his presidential council today, held according to the Soviet news agency TASS, specifically to discuss the Lithuania crisis. Afterward, the council issued a statement calling the recent action of the Lithuanian parliament a dead end. The present Lithuanian leadership, the statement goes on, is blocking any exit from the crisis with its anti-constitutional actions and the escalation of illegal measures. 4 days ago, the Lithuanian parliament sent a letter to Gorbachev pleading for the opening of negotiations over its independence decree. Today, Gorbachev's council concluded that additional economic, political, and other measures should be taken against Lithuania. The council did not specify what those measures should be. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
In Washington, the White House said today that problems in talks to cut long-range nuclear weapons will not affect plans for next month's summit meeting. White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said, "We have a lot of things to talk about besides arms control." President Bush and Soviet leader Gorbachev are to meet in the United States for 5 days, beginning May 30th. 24 hours after the polls closed in the Yugoslav Republic of Slovenia, there is still no official indication as to which party will control the state parliament. An unofficial tally arranged by the Election Commission is predicting a sweeping victory for the opposition coalition. Pierre Vickery has more on the story.
The official tally of seats in Slovenia's first multi-party election in 50 years will not be known until Thursday. But according to a preliminary count, the opposition Demos coalition will control the state parliament after securing over 51% of the popular vote. The ruling communists, now called the Party of Democratic Reform, emerged as the strongest single party, polling 20%, and together with the socialists and the liberals will hold over 42% of the seats in the assembly. In the race for state president, the communist candidate Milan Kucan had a large lead over his three opponents, but was unable to secure an absolute majority. He'll face a runoff election against the Demos party leader, Jože Pučnik, in 2 weeks' time. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Exxon said today that it will plead not guilty to a 5-count criminal indictment, charging it with violating various federal laws in connection with last year's spill off the coast of Alaska. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 5 points to close at 2,722.07, on volume of some 115 million shares. Trading was light. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and director John Waters built a cult following through his talent to shock and amuse. His repertory company of actors spotlighted people whose looks were considered social liabilities, but through exaggeration and caricature were turned into style. This was especially true of Divine, the 300-pound man who starred as a woman in such Waters films as Pink Flamingos, Polyester, and Hairspray. Hairspray was the movie that brought Waters mainstream success. His new movie, Crybaby, has an even bigger budget. Crybaby pays homage to the rock and roll teen exploitation films of the 50s. Squares and hoods face off and sing and dance. Johnny Depp of TV's 21 Jump Street is the leader of the hoods. Troy Donahue, Patty Hearst, Joey Heatherton, and Iggy Pop have cameos. This is from the movie's big prison production number after Johnny Depp is put behind bars.
Cut these shackles off of me.
Let me go, let me go.
This kind of suit don't set me free.
Set me free, set me free.
you want to do another teen film?
I wanted to do a musical, the kind where people break into song for no apparent reason, which I had never, ever done. A real early 50s musical. And it seems to me that they're always about teenagers, and the fact that I liked working with kids so much in Hairspray that it just seemed to me to be, I don't know, something I was comfortable with.
Yeah, it strikes me you're in the middle of this real perverse version of, you know, when I was young, we had good clean movies, and you're taking all these, like, young actors and saying, when I was young, we watched juvenile delinquent films.
Yeah, but it's so, today a juvenile delinquent is such a nice word, actually.
Yes, that's
it's
right.
A sexy word. I mean, so what I wanted to do was sort of in the spirit of Reefer Madness or those kind of movies, go back and make the most shocking move 1954 movie I could make, and I think that would be a comedy today. This movie couldn't have been shown in 1954.
Is it making you feel old at all to be casting teen stars and teaching them about the old days of juvenile delinquency?
Well, I like feeling old, so it doesn't bother me. The older I get, I think the happier I am. So that doesn't bother me. I think it's funny, certainly, that they don't remember any of this. But, you know, this took place in 54. I was only 8. I don't remember it all. I went to the library for a month and did research before I wrote this. So it's almost a historical movie to myself also.
1954 was a really scary year on the pop charts. You know, you had Perry Como doing Papa Loves
Square
Mambo.
Music,
yeah.
Right. That's what this is about, square music and drape music. And the square music was played on Your Hit Parade on television, and the top 10 was that, and all the squares listened to that. But the drapes, which was a Baltimore word, and some Philadelphia, I hear, were the hoods. And they listened to music that was generally black, and it was it sold millions of copies, but it was never played on the radio. It was only played on jukeboxes. Sort of a little bit like what rap is today.
Yeah, you use the word drapes for hoods. In Brooklyn, we used to call the hoods hitters.
Oh, that's a new one.
Is it new to you?
Yeah, well, because Greasers is sort of wrong, because Greasers is after rock and roll, and this movie takes place before rock and roll. So drapes were sort of in between Zoot Suits and Greasers. In between there was when drapes were. Johnny Ray was the first drape and crybaby that I remember.
So the movie set in 1954. You were 8 years old then.
Mm-hmm.
Were you watching teen movies at that time?
No. Well, my parents would have never taken me to those movies. No.
Yeah.
I had heard about The Wild One. All the real juvenile delinquent movies I saw much later in life, actually right before I wrote this movie. I remembered Girls Town, where Paul Anka sings Mamie Van Doren, the Ave Maria. I could never erase that from my mind. But that was the only one I remember. But I read a lot. I had a lot of books that had about them. And certainly you've seen those posters for years, like Drag Strip Girl and The Violent Years and all that stuff. So I thought that I wanted to make one in reverse, where the bad guys are the good guys and the good guys are the bad guys.
So when you went back and screened a lot of these old teen exploitation films,
mm-hmm.
Which stood out to you as being the most interesting?
Well, they were all pretty terrible, actually. That was the weird thing, but you could take little pieces from... My favorite is certainly The Girl Can't Help It, which is more of a musical. High School Confidential was certainly good. There was one, and I forget it, where this unwed mother had this girl where she'd come home. I was so pitiful. This, and I forget what it was called. Maybe Teenage Doll it was called, I think. It was. And that one had some funny unwed mother stuff in it, which I certainly sort of influenced Ricky Lake's character in this.
Yeah.
But in when I was 8, I couldn't be a drape. My parents wouldn't let me. I was still a square.
So when you were old enough to act on it, were you too old to really care?
The problem was I always had thin hair, and it's hard to be a drape with thin hair. But at the same time, also, I would have never been very good in gang fights. So as always, I watched. You know, I've always, that's what filmmakers always do. They watch.
The voyeur watching all the other drapes.
Yes,
all the
but
other drapes.
They knew, and there was a drapeette in my neighborhood, too, and I used to watch her bullet bra every day at the bus stop.
Did you have your actresses wear those?
Oh, yes. We have lots of bullet bras in this movie, definitely. Tracy Lords actually stabbed someone with her breast in it, which you could have done with these bras in the 50s.
I remember when I interviewed Mamie Van Doren, she said that they made her take one home so it would look like she looked this way all the time.
Right. And then they look like so uncomfortable. I mean, and, you know, Fredericks of Hollywood, I think, thought them up, and they have a bra museum, and they have a great one in the bra museum.
You've been there, no doubt.
Yes, I have been there, yeah. I think it travels even. It may come to, you know, a mall near you if you're lucky.
You've called this your first boy movie. What's
right.
the difference between a girl movie and a boy movie?
Well, my other one starred a boy, Divine, but he usually played a girl. That's the difference. It's the first movie I've had a male lead in it. Now, I think Johnny Depp and Divine, in some ways, I would never ever try to replace Divine. But in some ways, they are the same. They're both good actors, and they're both movie stars. They were just different ends of the spectrum.
How did you cast Johnny Depp in the lead?
I cast him because I never even considered anybody else. When I was writing the movie, I thought, who's going to play this? God, I mean, I don't have anybody in my repertory group. Offhand, I can't think of anybody. So I bought all the teen magazines, which is really an embarrassing thing to do when you're 43 years old and you're by yourself in Provincetown. And, you know, $30 worth of them. Like, I'll have Bump and Tutti Frutti. And he was in all of them, and he hates being in them, which I always kid him about it because that's how I found out about him. And he looked exactly like Crybaby. That was the first step. And all the other ones looked horrible to me. They were in these magazines. So I called him, and he was really funny on the phone. He liked my old movies, which is, I usually try to discourage actors if they don't know my earlier work from looking at it right before we shoot, because I figure it'll make them nervous and they might not do it. So, but he said he'd like Pink Flamingos and everything. And I could just tell that he had a sense of humor about himself, and he wanted to make fun of his own image, which when you agree to do a John Waters movie, that's almost in the contract.
Yeah, well, I figure, you know, someone has to be on your wavelength to make the movie. They have to have, like, a sense of humor. So you usually feel them out talking to them
beforehand? Yeah, I definitely do. And there's certainly a lot of names that you would think would be in a John Waters movie of people that I didn't hire. I'll never tell you who because it's not fair to the people who play the parts. But not everybody. I mean, and they all read for me. Patty Hearst read for me.
She was great, by the way.
Thanks.
She gave one of my favorite performances in the movie. She's so in the spirit of it.
She is. And I think, why not have some fun with being Patty Hearst for the first time? I mean, all that other stuff certainly wasn't fun for her. It was a big ordeal. So she didn't ask to be famous. She is famous, whether she likes it or not, for the rest of her life. So why not, for once, have fun? I mean, there's a paper in New York called Paper, and she's on the cover. And I love it because she's on the cover for being a movie actress.
Well, did you have to feel her out to see if she could be on the right wavelength for the movie?
Well, I knew that because I met her at the Cannes Film Festival, and there was something about her. We just instantly kind of got along, and it was peculiar because I had just seen the Patty Hearst movie, which I liked very, very much, and I told her that it had made me believe that she was innocent for the first time, which I guess is not the best, you know, some people wouldn't have been the best opening line in a friendship. And she had a sense of humor.
You have a big prison musical number in
right.
In Crybaby, and I was wondering if you screened Jailhouse Rock for Johnny Depp or if you already knew the movie.
I think he probably already knew it. I think the stuff I screened, Johnny did watch a lot of Elvis movies, but also all the juvenile delinquent movies I got, and Amy Locane, who's the female lead, I made her watch a lot of Anne Margaret movies, and because
right.
Anne is, I mean, there is a scene, if you've ever seen Viva Las Vegas, where Anne Margaret has a glamour fit where she... You think she's going to spontaneously combust from glamour. It is the most glamorous scene. She goes insane from glamour, and I showed Amy that a lot. Rent it out once, and just get to that scene when she comes out and sings Viva Las Vegas. It's amazing.
John Waters is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Waters. He wrote and directed the new comedy Crybaby, an homage to the teen exploitation films of the 50s. This is your first movie without Divine. Was the movie conceived when he was still alive?
No, it's also not the first movie. Desperate Living, Divine was not in.
Okay.
No, it was completely written after Divine had passed away. So I had no way... I would never replace him. I would never use a man playing a woman. I was so paranoid, actually, that anybody would think I was trying to replace him with any part, that I don't really think you'll see any part in this that Divine would have or could have played, because the very fact I knew he couldn't. If Divine had been alive, certainly he would have been in Crybaby, and it would be a different script, and I don't know in what way, because I never wrote it that way.
Had his health been okay before he died?
As much as it can be for if you're very overweight. He always had a sleeping disorder. It was impossible to even sleep in his apartment because of the amount of noise he made from just gasping for breath. So it was always scary to hear him sleep. It certainly was a shock that he died, but how he died was not surprising to anybody that knew him. And I think certainly, you know, when Johnny came to town, in a very unghoulish way, we went to the cemetery because we go there a lot, and it was around Christmas, and we bring donuts and Christmas trees and everything to the grave. So it was sort of a symbolic thing in a way, this passing of this some whatever it is. And the first day when I looked through the camera and saw Johnny, the first take was Johnny driving up on a motorcycle. And I said, well, it is a boy movie for the first time. But Johnny and Divine would have liked each other very, very, very much. And to me, they're both good actors and movie stars. And that was it.
Divine's funeral was in Baltimore, right?
Right.
I assume it was organized by his family.
It was. It was organized, unfortunately, by his family and our press agents because it happened right after Hairspray had opened. So, Divine would have liked it. Divine would have liked to have leapt from his coffin and done the twist on the top of it. It was a media event of sorts only because of the story that, well, because he died, period. But it was handled well. But all our friends were there and all his family was there, and it was very nice. His family was very, very gracious.
Was there a lot of like odd discussion between family and press agent and friends about how to dress?
Oh,
his corpse?
No, because Divine never ever dressed as a woman.
No, I don't mean to dress as a woman, but to dress in a tux or to dress.
Oh, he had
in
on. He looked like Alfred Hitchcock.
He'd wear.
He looked like Alfred Hitchcock. It was a open casket, which wouldn't have been my choice, but. I find that scary, but obviously they didn't. And he looked good. He looked like Alfred Hitchcock. He had his big diamond stud earring on and a black tie.
Did you have a separate ceremony of just friends afterwards?
Oh, no. We had a big wake afterwards, yes. Uh-huh. But no, because it was a great funeral, actually. It was, and the reverend that spoke was wonderful. You know, he knew Divine as a little boy, and he was very, very good. He said, frankly, we didn't know what to do. And later, the reverend told me a good story that after the New Yorker wrote up Divine's funeral, and there was all these evangelists called this preacher, not a preacher, this reverend, and said, how could you bury Divine? You know what he did at the end of Pink Flamingos, and the reverend said, well, theologically, it's certainly not a sin to eat dog do, which I thought was great and a very, you know, what religious people should say.
No, I read that you gave up smoking.
Yes, I'm embarrassed to be a non-smoker. I hate non-smokers. I could never love a non-smoker. And, but yes, I did.
I was wondering if that had anything to do with Divine's death, you know, with this, like, maybe new sense of mortality.
I think there were two reasons. The main reasons is, one, I had a horrible cough that sounded frightening, and the day I stopped, I never coughed again. And secondly, my brother had a brain tumor. My brother is fine now. They did an operation. Everything's fine. But that, even though it has nothing to do with smoking, that mortality thing, I think, is what pushed me over. And also, I quit smoking in the most ludicrous way in the Beverly Hills smoking clinic where they give you these shots full of drugs behind your ears, and it made me completely insane. I would never advise anybody to quit smoking.
What made you enter a clinic-type situation?
Because people I knew, Robert Downey, had told me that it worked, and all these people that were militant smokers told that it worked for them. And I've later showed the brochures and what was in these shots to many doctors who said it has nothing to do with smoking. However, it worked for me. But I could, if I smoked one cigarette, I'd smoke 2,000 of them tomorrow to make up for the 6 months that I haven't smoked.
Do you have dreams where you smoke a cigarette and you figure, I'm hooked again?
Yes, that's frightening in the beginning. You certainly do that. But there's nothing more boring than listening to addicts talk about their old drugs.
The Johnny Depp character in Crybaby mm-hmm. has like one tear that streams down his eye. That's his kind of trademark. You could never get him to cry, but he has one tear.
Right.
How did you come up with that conceit?
I don't know. Just like cheesy symbolism. You know? And the idea of a tough guy doing, and I don't know. And Crybaby, the song, was the first 45 I ever bought as a child when I was about 8 years old. And so that I liked the name. I thought it was a sexy kind of fun name to say, and that's so obviously I had to think of how he was going to cry, and that just somehow came.
The Bunny Hop is one of the records in
the
movie.
That's like the Squares Bolero.
Were you ever, in my family at weddings and bar mitzvahs and things like that, mm-hmm. back in the old days, there'd always be a bunny hop.
Oh, I had to do it too.
Really? This was the time to, like, go to the ladies' room and hide.
Well, at least it was easy to do, but it was just the problem with the bunny hop is you hop up and then back and then three times forward, so it takes an hour to go afoot. That was what I always hated about it. It was just such slow going to get to the other side of the room, but it's a very obnoxious dance, I think, and they kept saying, well, we should put it on the record album. I said, are you kidding? It can't be. It would drive people crazy to listen to that. No matter if it was first, last, where you placed it on the CD, it would make people take it off.
So it's not on there?
No.
Oh.
Well, every song is not anyway. But, I mean, it would have been torture. It's like the Squares Bolero.
So what were the occasions when you had to do the bunny hop?
At dancing class that I had to go to, which was certainly this cotillion thing, which in my mind, was worse than, like, going to the, I don't know, the worst McMartin school, if everything was true. And I don't know, certainly the RSVP charm school is based on that.
No kidding. So not only weren't you a drape, but you had to go to this charm school type of place.
Yes, which is just like what the, well, charm school, actually, they would never use that word because really
for boys.
Trash
yeah.
went to charm school.
Right.
But this was, certainly I went to a cotillion kind of place that was exactly like the one that's in this.
So what else did you learn there?
I learned how to want to be a juvenile delinquent. I learned, I discovered rage for the first time. That's what I learned. Fantasies of murdering all the people that ran it.
What did they think they were teaching you?
How to be a gentleman, which, believe me, I think I know how to act like a gentleman, but I didn't learn it there. I had fantasies there of whipping out a submachine gun, being like Charles Whitman does the waltz, is basically my fantasies. And, you know, I said this in an interview, and the woman who ran this place wrote a letter to Baltimore Magazine last month and saying, I remember him as a lovely, shy young man, and if I can take any credit even from his misery, I will. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, gosh. Did you have to dress up to go to the school?
Yes, you had to go there. And the worst was they taught you their version of the jitterbug, which was so square that you would be so mortified if anybody ever saw you doing it.
Were you ever...
Everybody hated it.
Now you could look back at this and laugh, right? But did you go...
No, I can't laugh. I want to shed a single tear. I could start sobbing and call a psychiatrist because...
Was there ever a period in your life when you tried to cover this up and pretend like it never happened, didn't let anybody
it
know?
It wasn't. Well, I just remember it as being something. I learned how to hook it, and eventually my parents would drop me off, and I'd go to the movies downtown. At least I got to go downtown from it. But, no, I remember just dreading it. That and Sunday school were the two things that I just thought, oh, God, now this. I mean, it certainly created a rebellion in me. So I guess I should be very thankful for it. And I've certainly used it, my memories of it, and exaggerated and fantasized them and fictionalized them into a movie. So... That's what I'm saying. All your bad experiences are character building.
Hey, I'll keep that in mind. John Waters, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
John Waters wrote and directed the new film, Cry Baby. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. What do you have, Linda?
Terry, we're talking about Pepsi today and the swap that Pepsi's doing, vodka and ships for Pepsi in the Soviet Union. Civil unrest in Nepal is also something we're going to be talking about, discussing how things like that are happening in such a peaceful place as Nepal has always been. The aftermath of the Poindexter trial, Nina Totenberg is coming in to talk about why things turned out the way they did, and Dan Shore to talk about what might happen next. And we're going to be talking Texas, Terry. That's been quite some campaign in that state, and we're going to take one more look at it before they vote.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Capital News is television's latest venture into a big city newsroom. TV critic David Bianculli sees how it stacks up against a previous drama set in that world.
I loved Lou Grant. I liked the characters, I liked the way the show dealt with topical issues, and most of all, I liked watching a show about the newspaper business. Even though they had to stretch a lot to make things interesting for TV, the MTM production staff got a lot of it right. Well, it's been 8 years since CBS canceled Lou Grant, and there hasn't been a good newspaper TV series since. Now there is. It's ABC's Capital News, and it's another MTM production. MTM Productions is way past its glory days, though, so it's the other names involved in Capital News that are more impressive. Behind the scenes, there's Hill Street Blues writer-producer David Milch and Sane Elsewhere producer-director Mark Tinker. And the cast, well, like a couple of other new ABC series, Equal Justice and Twin Peaks, it's a really strong collection of talent. Lloyd Bridges is the editor. William Russ, who played Roger LeCoco on Wise Guy, is a Metro reporter. Jenny Wright, the beautiful bloodsucker in the vampire film Near Dark, is another Metro reporter. Helen Slater, star of Supergirl and The Secret of My Success, is the new transfer to Cityside. Michael Woods and Catherine Harold also star, and Kurt Fuller makes a very funny first impression. He plays Miles Plato, a mega-successful gossip columnist who dresses like Tom Wolfe and conducts himself like Arnie Becker, especially when he's charming one of his female sources.
Let's see, do we want you back on the White House switchboard? No, let's put you in the Senate gym this time.
I liked it at the Pentagon.
Call this number. You start tomorrow. You'll be giving out towels and scheduling the handball. You're bound to hear things.
If I'd made it to 3 months, they were going to give me a parking space. And then this facelift thing came along and you spent me like a penny.
You know the rules. All my assets have to be expendable.
Well, Jamaica's not expendable and she's just a hotel maid. Oh.
Angela.
And Tanya got a tanning salon for a listening post. And she's been there so long now she looks Polynesian.
Angie, since you've been one of my operatives, have you ever been unemployed for more than a day?
No.
Do you need to talk to the chief?
No. Oh, Miles. You know we don't do it for the money. We're the ears of the world. It's like you always say, we're the back fence of the global village.
The two-hour pilot of Capital News is a lot like the one for Equal Justice. Its cast keeps you interested, but the storyline isn't all that extraordinary. In fact, some of the stuff borders on silly. Too many of the reporters are too dedicated, and everybody spends too much time together outside of work. The editors play poker together, and the best reporters live together in some kind of journalistic commune. Now, the show is set in Washington, D.C., where rent isn't cheap. But couldn't these guys get their own homes, much less their own lives? But look, the exploding video display terminals and those outrageous confrontations between the writers and the people they're writing about are things I'm willing to forgive. I expect Capital News to settle down like Lou Grant did and tell topical stories using a bunch of gifted actors. And while that's hardly stopped the press's news, it is good news. And another likable, watchable springtime series from ABC.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Matthew Modine, star of the movies Gross Anatomy, Birdie, and Married to the Mob. Also, anthropologist and naturalist Richard Nelson tells us what he found on an abandoned island near his home. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.